Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne is brought to you in part by Evergreen Realty. Commercial and residential property listings. Online at evergreen-realty.com.
Hello, and welcome to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne here at 88.5 KRFY, community radio for North Idaho. I am Dr. Joanne, and I hope you'll enjoy the medical topics I've chosen to present at 8 a.m. on the first Monday of every month. You can also catch the show at 8 a.m. on the third Monday, and our show and every show at KRFY is on your radio at 88.5 or can be streamed at krfy.org. from anywhere in the world. If you enjoy podcasts, you can listen to a podcast of the show, again at krfy.org, and select the podcast tab. This month, I'll be discussing functional regenerative integrative medicine with two practitioners who are here with me in the studio this morning, Jeremy Allen, PA-C, and Jill Stiller, APRN-CNP, FMCP. And I think I know what all those letters mean. PA is physician's assistant, and C is certified, or?
Yep.
And advanced practice nurse, clinical nurse practitioner, and then functional medicine.
Certification,
okay. Please introduce yourselves to our audience. Jeremy, why don't you start?
My name is Jeremy Allen. I'm a PA, that's physician associate or physician assistant. And I have two jobs here in Sandpoint. I'm a geriatric primary care provider at assisted living facilities. And then I have my own practice doing regenerative medicine as a concierge medicine provider.
And your training?
I have an undergraduate degree in biochemistry. And then I went to Yale School of Medicine for the physician associate program.
Okay. And Jill?
My name is Jill Stiller. I am a certified nurse practitioner, as well as certified through the Institute of Functional Medicine. And I have a private practice in town. And I was a primary care provider taking insurance. Now I just do direct care services.
Okay. And where did you train?
I trained, I have my undergrad in botany from the University of Washington. And then I have my nursing degree from the University of Arizona. And then I have my master's from Gonzaga for nurse practitioner, and then I'm certified through the Institute of Functional Medicine that's out of Renton, Washington.
All right, go Zags. Also in the studio with us is Susie Perez from our morning show here at KRFY. I call her my executive producer. She enables KRFY to offer these discussions. Hi, Susie, and thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Dr. Joanne, and thanks for doing the show. Medical Musing provides the KRFY listeners interesting and informative interviews on a variety of medical and health-related subjects, and we really appreciate that you're doing this. I know you have a lot of listeners now. I wanted to let the listeners know a little bit about who you are. Dr. Joanne is a longtime KRFY volunteer, previously hosting segments of Otto's Eclectic Mix, and is now hosting Medical Musing, which, as you said, the first and third Monday of the month is when it airs at 8 a.m. Dr. Joanne is a retired pediatrician who has lived in Sandpoint since 2010. She previously worked in a pediatric practice in Columbus, Ohio for over 30 years and then covered at Sandpoint Pediatrics once she moved here. As the medical media spokesperson for the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, she contributed to print, online media, radio, and television. She's a mother of four adult children. And again, we're so fortunate to have your show as part of our Monday morning programming. Thank you.
Thank you, Susie. I'm going to give a little background on what we called CAM, CAM, during my years in pediatric practice. I always found it interesting that CAM meant complementary alternative medicine. It's complementary to traditional Western medicine and also an alternative. Although scientific publications and medical associations would question the benefits of alternative medicine, even call some disciplines quackery, many physicians would either personally or professionally recommend many of these treatment modalities. We'll discuss with Jeremy and Jill whether these recommendations are unproven or whether they are supported by medical scientific evidence. When I would evaluate a study as an attending physician with the pediatric residents and hospital staff, we always look to determine whether a study was double-blind, placebo-controlled, that's a lot of letters, or a retrospective chart analysis, an RCT, or a randomized clinical trial, an RCT, or a retrospective chart analysis regarding a particular condition. Double-blind, what does that mean? Well, it means neither the subject nor the researcher knows what treatment a specific subject is receiving. Placebo control means one group of subjects isn't even actually receiving the treatment or the medication. These methods were helped to eliminate bias. The reason I either utilize these treatments or medications in my practice or for me personally or for patients was that I had a condition or they had a condition for which standard medical treatments didn't seem to work or created unwanted side effects. Perhaps the patient was on too many medicines and we needed to start over with a clean slate. It could be an herbal medicine that I used, melatonin or valerian to induce sleep, chondroitin sulfate for joint pain, vitamin A for acne, massage, Reiki, guided imagery. An herbal life dealer came to our practice with a concoction to lose weight. There are menopausal treatments to avoid hormone therapy, chiropractic, osteopathic manipulation. There are so many people with certain aspects of pain. It can be joint pain, headaches, esophageal, reflux, generalized abdominal pain, and so many others. So we went from old-fashioned aspirin to acetaminophen that has no anti-inflammatory properties to so many non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Most people know ibuprofen, but I can list, 5, 6, 10 more, non-nicardic, and then, of course, the narcotics. They can be helpful, but they can also be harmful at the same time. It was interesting to me that 30% of drug-related hospital admissions are related to NSAIDs because they cause GI and other bleeding and on to kidney damage. So if a basic tenet of medical providers is first do no harm, what do? Tell us what led each of you to study functional medicine. Jill, do you want to start?
Well, I went into functional medicine through my own personal health journey of going into the Western medicine system and finding that I was given a Latin binomial for my symptoms with just surgery and medications as a solution. And I did not find that was going to help me heal. And so I started researching things outside of that system to find ways to overcome autoimmune disease when I was in my 20s, as well as cancer when I was older. So I had to find a system that helped me heal. And then I wanted to be able to share that with others. And so I got more interested in functional medicine.
Very interesting. Jeremy, tell us about your journey.
Mine's pretty similar. I think a lot of providers that kind of start venturing into the alternative world kind of have their own personal stuff or family stuff. I've always been interested in food. I actually quit medicine for a couple of years to be a farmer, which my parents were not stoked about. But it was a great way to kind of get connected to the land and also to see where our food comes from. I have 4 little children. And it kind of became very important to me how I was feeding them and what I was feeding them with. And, I went to a good medical program, and I think we had 30 minutes of nutrition. I don't know about your program, if they even talked about food.
Not at all.
Yeah, and it's, that's a problem. Hippocrates said, let thy food be thy medicine, and thy medicine be thy food. And that's Hippocrates is one of our heroes in medicine. So I think my journey came through food primarily.
Very interesting. One of you defined for me functional medicine, and are functional medicine, regenerative medicine, and integrative medicine all the same?
Well, I can start with functional medicine term came from Dr. Jeff Bland, and he started that in 1991, and he was a biochemist that was interested in nutrition and trying to come up with a system biology approach to finding the root cause of disease and dysfunction in people and creating a system with which providers could use to get to the bottom of the problem.
Okay.
I think a lot of these terms are interchangeable for the greater extent. It's kind of the cool term now. Regenerative medicine is the latest term. And a lot of people use that specifically when you're taking a part of your own body and putting it back into your body. PRP is probably the most common, commonly known one, which is platelet-rich plasma, which is when you take out your blood and then you spin it down and get the plasma part out and then put it into a joint space, typically for orthopedic healing. But there's lots of different forms, stem cells and other ways. I think integrative medicine is similar. It's just kind of combining all the old school stuff, the natural, quote unquote, natural stuff, and combining that with our more conventional medicine model.
Was CAM simply something east of the Mississippi? When
I was studying, CAM was a very common term when I was studying nurse practitioner as a nurse as well, because I worked with Dr. Weil when I was at University of Arizona. And so he was doing the integrative medicine he had a fellowship program he was developing when I was there. And so I did a lot of training with him back in the 90s. And it was very, to me, it was very basic common sense interventions, okay. You know, looking at food as medicine and looking at people's lifestyle and diet, as well as their social and spiritual space that they would be in that creates, you know, whether they have dis-ease or wellness.
Okay. Because that's where I started, with the complementary alternative medicine. And I said that to a doctor here, and he looked at me like he had no idea what I was talking about. So it's just interesting. And then, of course, we have allopathic medicine or traditional Western medicine, which you both started out in. And, of course, that's where my training was. When I was doing a little background on this, I, you know, looked at homeopathy, too. And I was so fascinated that Dr. Hahnemann started in 1796 diluting, and saying that, you know, like cures like, what causes illness in well people can cure the illness in those sick with the disease when administered in these super, super diluted solutions. There were even colleges, medical schools who were devoted to homeopathy, and it kind of transitioned out around the 1920s. My brother-in-law worked in Philadelphia at Jefferson, and so I knew of Hahnemann, and Hahnemann was associated with St. Christopher's for Children, and some very, very well-known pediatric experts in endocrinology came out of St. Christopher's for Children. It was also associated with Drexel and the Jefferson Medical College. Unfortunately, Hahnemann doesn't exist, but I think it's probably not because it was devoted to homeopathy, but just because there are so many other hospital systems in the Philadelphia area.
And in Europe, I think homeopathy is quite well known. In England, the royal family uses homeopathy quite a lot, and it's part of what they've been doing and integrated into the whole picture.
Yeah, it was coming back, especially from the 1970s on. So when Jeremy and I were talking previously, I was reminded that there's really a new panel of medical providers and not just MDs who all have a role. So do you want to discuss that?
Oh, man, there's so many names and so many letters. I think, you know, I think the key is that it's not confusing for patients to know who's providing their care. And in terms of people who have prescriptive powers, which is probably a good starting place, there's MDs, medical doctors, there's DOs, doctors of osteopathy, who go to a different style of medical programming. And then there's what have been termed as mid-level providers and advanced practice clinicians. And those are what Jill and I are, which is PAs, physician associates, and nurse practitioners, NPs. And then there's another realm. There's doctors can also be PhDs, and lawyers are technically doctors. But DCs are doctors of chiropractic, so chiropractic doctors. Can you think of anyone else?
And there's not naturopathic doctors.
Naturopathic doctors, of course. NDs, yes. That's a big, they're a big player as well.
And then people who just seem to be herbalists or all the different therapists that come under psychology
and
counselors.
What about physical therapists? Did you mention that?
Yeah, so yes. Physical therapists can actually get doctorates in physical therapy. It mm-hmm. gets touchy because they can't call themselves doctors in a clinical setting because it can be confusing to patients. There's a lot of laws in various states protecting the term doctor. But they are therapists. There's massage therapists, who are actually incredibly important role players, in my opinion, to the clinical and wellness experience.
That's where I came in.
Yeah, yeah.
Your massage, no. And also, like I had said before, you know, sleep, okay, try melatonin. Ew, I felt weird. Oh, try valerian. Oh, that didn't really do much either. So you keep going through these things. Or my sister-in-law was recommended ginkgo, and she found out that then she couldn't sleep, and she loves to nap. Mm. So then ginkgo went by the board. So, I mean, there are lots of things that people try over the years, have to decide if it helps.
It's a keen picture of everyone's a little bit different. For me, it's magnesium glycinate. It works. I sleep. But someone else, it is melatonin. So learning your body, having a practitioner that works with you to find out what works and what doesn't is important.
So what are your thoughts on the increased interest in functional or regenerative medicine now, holistic medicine?
I think a lot of people are finding the pill for an ill modality of Western medicine isn't like quite that. Working for most people, because there's a lot of our system is set to look outside of yourself for a solution. And typically the solution to health is within. And so I think people really have been ever since the development of penicillin in my grandmother's generation, everybody thought, oh, you go to the doctor, you get a pill and you'll be better. And so instead of addressing potential underlying dysfunctions or imbalances within their own body that are creating symptoms, they're instead looking outside of themselves for a solution, and they're finding that that's failing them. And so over time, I'm finding people are not getting the help that they want. And so they're starting to look for alternatives.
So, yeah, if we first do no harm, everyone's, though, is looking for treatments, as Susie said, and we've previously discussed, that relieve the symptoms but don't have side effects. I assume there are also concerns about additives and toxins and the approval process for certain medicines. Some are approved and then they're withdrawn, and that can be very confusing to the public. What are the symptoms that patients usually present to you with, Jeremy?
Oh, gosh. All sorts of things. I mean, I think Jill kind of touched on it. We've come to this point where we've created an exchange where people come to their provider and they're expecting to get a thing from that exchange, and they don't really look into their own lifestyle. And then we look around, and objectively speaking, we, at least in the United States, we are so much more unhealthy than we've been in a very long time. I mean, chronic disease is rampant. And so if you look at our traditional system, everybody's got autoimmune disease, and there's diabetes and high blood pressure and cardiovascular disease, and it's getting worse, not better, despite our advances in medical care, which is what I think is getting a lot of people, patients and providers alike, to step back and say, okay, we must be missing something. And so you ask me, what do they come to me with? I mean, literally everything, pre and post surgical stuff, orthopedic issues. They're not sleeping well. I mean, sometimes they're really basic. I don't know, what are you seeing a lot of?
I see pretty much the same thing. I deal with a lot of hormone problems is kind of the people that come to see me, because I find that that is not well cared for most people, because everybody doesn't understand the underlying drivers for some of those hormone imbalances. And so I think it's really important for people to really consider what is happening inside their internal milieu, or what's happening inside their cells. That is really important to understand if there's like a nutritional deficiency or some kind of epigenetic change that has occurred from an environmental toxin. It's really important to understand what kind of dysfunction is creating that symptom, so they can create balance in their bodies again, so that symptom will go away. Instead of taking a pill to mask a symptom, I think it's sometimes that can be helpful. Of course, I've definitely used that personally, but you also want to know why is your body giving you that symptom, and what is it trying to tell you, and trying to get to the bottom of that is really important.
So if a new patient comes to you, tell me about your evaluation, your workup, your treatment, and do you refer out for certain modalities?
Oh, definitely. For me, there's kind of a framework within functional medicine that we use. It's called the go-to-it model, where we gather information, we organize it, and we have long visits with people so they can tell our story. We can tell it back to make sure we understand the situation. And then I'll go about ordering potential tests depending on the story that's individualized for each person, and then initiate all kinds of interventions, and then track how that's working for them, and circle back around and see how things are going. Because using a systemic biology approach to try to come to using this matrix model in order to help people find their underlying drivers for their this dysfunction.
If I could point out one thing, though, that you said that is the most important thing from my perspective is we take a lot of time.
Yes.
And that's the challenge, right? Because everything she just described for you, you did that as a pediatrician all the time. We interview our patients. We try to find out some stuff. Maybe we order some tests. But our current conventional model is you've got 15 minutes because we have a full day and I better catch everything. And if you're meeting someone for the first time and they have decades of health issues. Yeah. They're not going to, there's no way we can get through all of that in 15 minutes. That's what I do too. I take way longer than my traditional, my ER years and my internal medicine years ever allowed me to kind of get to know somebody, make a connection.
So true.
I think that's a critical part that we're noticing in this kind of alternative style.
Yes. My first appointments are usually an hour and a half to 2 hours long versus when I was a primary care provider and under a productivity quota, I was forced to see patients in 15 minutes.
Yeah. If I needed a longer one, I would schedule a consultation, but you always got the 15-minute visit, and then as they're walking out the door, there was always the, oh, by the way, she's had headaches for 4 months or something like that. Oh, by the way. Susie?
Well, so I've been to a functional medicine practitioner. And one thing I noticed was the long amount of time she stayed with me. The pre-appointment was a lot of questionnaire, but she really listened. And at the end, she said, I want to work with you to understand what you need, and we can work together. I want to see you at 95, 95. Mm-hmm. I want to see your life be well. And, with telemedicine nowadays, we can visit at any point in time if something comes up. A lot of testing. She found out a lot of things. But that time and how she listened to my story, as you say, that really made a big difference. And she knows me.
So where was the testing done? And then, of course, you were required to pay for it.
Absolutely. And you know what? Our health is wealth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Do you know where the lab was sent? I'm just curious.
I think they use a lab .
We use a lot of different lab. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different lab testing companies that do different types of functional medicine testing. And so we can do serum labs. We can do urine organic acid testing. We can also look at stool testing. So there's a variety of different ways that you can do testing, but it's all individualized based on the individual's story and needs at that time.
The microbiome has become front and center in our discussion about health, and understanding that was really new to me. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of digestive testing that they can do. Again, it's not inexpensive, but it's worth it.
It's worth it for you. Mm-hmm. So, Jeremy, tell me where you feel like allopathic medicine and regenerative medicine overlap.
Oh, it's all one big thing. I mean, there's no separation. I think when you try to separate it, that's when you start to create issues. There's certainly a role for pharmaceutics, 100%. There's certainly a role for the hospital. You know, I make a joke all the time that when I take care of my patients, I will do everything I can to keep them out of the hospital. But if they're in a car accident, you call 911. You go to the hospital and get evaluated. I can't fix your C-spine with, a healing touch and hyperbarics, for example. Maybe after you get injured, we can start talking about the healing and the recovery phase. But there's tons of overlap. I think we've gotten into these camps, unfortunately, about, it's all about herbalism or it's all about naturopathics or it's all about, allopathics. And I think the real key is kind of integrating everything. And that's why integrative medicine is a great term, because we should be combining all of the components of care. I think that we shouldn't be jumping to pharmaceutics first. Right. I think we should be trying to figure out the root cause. Why is this happening?
I 100% agree. That's why my company is called Integrative Health Solutions, because I believe we can use the best of all worlds to help somebody get better.
If someone presents to you, though, with multi-pharmacy, how do you have a plan for weaning? You can't just say stop all your medicines. That might be
never
dangerous.
Never, yeah, terrible idea.
That's a terrible idea.
Yeah. I mean, I think we look at why are you on these medicines. I think that's the first question.
First question is why are you on these medicines, and so you want to look at what is the underlying driver for that particular problem. So if you think of the standard American person with hypertension, hyperlipidemia, with diabetes. And so you look at typically their lifestyle involves they're not moving, potentially smoking, drinking alcohol. And so they're not dealing with the underlying drivers that could be helping them get better. So we know that basic things like if you move your body, you have a better blood pressure and you don't typically have the problems of living sedentary lifestyle. And so a lot of things happen. It comes back to your mitochondria in my mind. And so I'm not going to go deep dive into that. But it's just really important for people to understand what is driving their underlying health issues instead of thinking a pill is going to solve it. Typically, that can give you some reprieve, but it's not the solution.
Susie?
I have a quick question. Are there moments in time when you work with the primary care medical doctor as a integrative, you know, because you're integrating?
Always.
Yeah.
I typically always did want people to have a primary care provider for, I was a primary care provider. And so people definitely need to follow up with them. I'm more of a person that they would see to do like a consult so they could kind of like get a redirection, but I'm not going to be trying to take over the role of their primary care provider. And I definitely refer people to surgeons or whoever else they might need to see, because I'm just there as a consult to try to help them heal themselves versus trying to replace what their current system is.
And I do a little bit of both. I am a primary care provider to people, and also I kind of fill that consultative role where I'm combining stuff. I'm totally with Jill on that.
So alternative medicine doesn't really mean to ignore the scientific process. Is that true or false?
It's totally true.
Yeah.
I think the in Western medicine, there, you know, I was on evidence-based practice committees for years when I was working in intensive care. And so what I see is the evidence is 20 years behind the practice implementation. And so I find there is a lot of evidence supporting everything we do in functional and integrative health space, but a lot of our practice isn't reflective of that. But I imagine in the future, as it becomes more apparent, it will become more obvious.
We have countless examples throughout history of the active science and active practice being completely, you know, disparate, where the science is, you know, decades ahead of where we're actively practicing. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the last 100 years, at least, I can name many examples of that. You know, you talked about the microbiome. We've known about the microbiome for over 30 years. Our understanding of it now being like, part of the overall health is very different now than it was 30 years ago. But we've known about it, but yet we live in a very antibacterial life. Everything is antibacterial. And so if we honor the fact that we have trillions of other organisms living inside of all of us, managing the majority of our immune system, all of our digestive system, how we get most of our nutrients.
And our immune system and metabolism.
Yeah.
On top of that. But we started using the microbiome even in the intensive care unit, because what we found is that when people had, you know, because I started doing microbiome stuff even 20 years ago in the ICU, because when people had like toxic megacolon, we found that if we did fecal transplants for them, we could prevent them from having surgery and save their colon. And so to me, they've known about this stuff for a long time. And even in the intensive care units where I worked in the past, we did a lot of probiotic interventions to try to decrease hospitalization stays in the ICU to save money for the hospital system.
Well,
so
no, yeah.
There's ways to integrate this to actually benefit all systems, I think, and to help people get better and be more healthy, and that will benefit our society in general.
That's so interesting, because we've, in our practice, we always used probiotics. I mean, I might even been the 80s or the 90s, and especially, of course, when children were treated with antibiotics, we would always recommend yogurt, kefir, the Culturel, which was supposed to be the best of the probiotics, and there's so many other probiotics, and lactobacillus that, you know, the number of colonies, how many millions of units a patient should have. I mean, we always, I mean, from, I know it was the 90s on, the early 90s on. So specifically, the microbiome written up in literature was being, again, as Jill said, we were thinking about that way, way back years ago.
But then you can also enter this problem of supplements in the United States are not checked out by anybody. Every single supplement you buy will have a little statement on it. The FDA has not checked us out, pretty much, is what they say. And so they can do anything. There's lots of studies that show that things like probiotic supplements, do not actually provide any benefit to you whatsoever. And yet we can move towards fermented food, which is what you mentioned. Yeah. So yogurt, kefir, kombucha, sauerkraut, kimchi, those things, they're living organisms or living foods we put in our body. Yeah. So I always try to steer people a little bit from getting too excited about supplements.
No, and that's very interesting, because then the PR would come and go. It'd be like, you know, oh, do this or give this, and then be, oh, no, you know, back to the more natural thing. So, yeah, the one problem with supplements is that they're not regulated.
Yeah, one problem I've seen in my practice, some people come to me and they want to, they're taking a lot of medications and they want to replace them. They want to say, what can I take instead of this blood pressure medicine? What supplement can I take? And I'm like, that's not what functional medicine is at all. It's not, there's not a supplement for every ill either, because supplements can sometimes, they're supposed to be, they're called supplements because they're supposed to be supplemental to a good diet, not replacements. And so I think a lot of times people think of them as replacements and they don't want to make the difficult changes that need to be made in terms of what they're putting in their mouth and how they're thinking and living in this world and relating to other people. Because to me, the root causes of health are typically go back to how stressed are you, how well you sleep, how well you move, what you put in your mouth, and what are your relationships with yourself and others. And so usually you have to address those underlying drivers of dysfunction, and there's no supplement that's going to change the way you interact with other people.
It's very important for our audience to know. Thank you.
But the multi-billion-dollar supplement industry certainly does not want you
sure
to know that.
It sure does make it easy, right? Yeah, and that's why we have a multi-billion-dollar medical pharmaceutical industry as well. That's
totally
driving our entire healthcare system, unfortunately, away from health and care into just disease management.
Yeah.
Think of going to a drugstore, though, and look at all the rows and rows and rows of different supplements, vitamins, you know,
What's interesting to me is I found that the first pharmaceutical that was created was that when the pharmaceuticals were first created, they weren't taken for more than a week. And so they came up with birth control pills. And that was the first time the pharmaceutical companies decided, hey, we can get people to take pills every day for years. And this became a new market for them. And so I think, unfortunately, we have to recognize that that system is a business model and they're trying to make money, and that people can get sucked their health into that and forget that they are responsible for their health, and it's not something outside of them that's really going to fix them. It can help them feel better temporarily while they're working on things, but you definitely people need to be more responsible for their own health and not think that somebody else can fix it for them.
And that's where going to a functional medicine practitioner, you become partners in understanding things that could change, you could work on, make a difference. And as you say, a whole lifestyle approach.
And certainly genetics play a role. And certainly there's other things that are sort of outside of your own ability to control. You know, I have a family history of a genetic disease. Mm-hmm. Can't really eat my way out of that.
Yes.
Or exercise my way out of that. So there is some kind of expertise, knowledge that a functional or generative or integrative provider or a regular, you know, quote unquote, regular MD could provide for you. However, I think that, Jill, I think you're totally on the money. I think it's relationships, it's how we move, how we sleep, how we eat. Those are really kind of the pillars of health, and so that's really important.
And as most people have probably recognized, some of our food is becoming an issue in our society, because our gut, as we go back to the microbiome, I think our microbiome is a reflection of the health of our soil and where we grow our food. And so as long as because my first interest was in regenerative farming, and I did the same thing that Jeremy did and tried to grow all my food for my children and make sure they knew where their food come from, because I realized how important this was after I had to heal from my own health issues and wanted to prevent that for my children. But I think that we are just a reflection of the environment, and so our health is a reflection of the health of our environment, and we can't really separate ourselves from that. So our microbiome of our soils are broken, so therefore our gut microbiome is broken. And so I was in my younger years, I was more interested in, you know, save the earth kind of thing. But what I found is as long as the people were sick, the earth was going to be sick. And so we really need to find a way so we can heal, so our environment can heal as well.
Wonderful. We need to do a station identification, and we'll be right back.
This is 88.5 KRFY. This is your independent, commercial-free radio station in North Idaho, and that's what you're listening to. And our guests are, again,
Jeremy Allen, Jill Stiller, and myself, Dr. Joanne.
We're talking about functional, integrative, and regenerative medicine today.
I was so interested, again, as I was doing a little background, of how many medical centers all around the country have functional integrative medical clinics. From close to us, at Cleveland Clinic, to Mass General, to New York Presbyterian, where my son-in-law is an ear, nose, and throat doc, to down the coast to Pennsylvania and George Washington, Florida and Miami and Vanderbilt, and then across to Stanford. Were you all, have you visited any of those? Or it sounds like with your background that we are very fortunate in North Idaho to have people who understand these systems and the coordination of providers. Comments?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think as, again, as everybody seems to recognize, it's not the pill for the ill. I love that. I've never heard that before, actually, but I really like that. We're moving away from that, and people are looking towards all of the possible therapies that will help them feel better. And so, you know, the big research institutes from Hopkins to Yale, you know, kind of all the Ivy Leagues, and the big centers, Penn, and, you know, they're all looking into how can we bring this in? Because again, we're talking about evidence-based practices, which I was this, you know, kind of a crusader for evidence-based medicine when I was working in the hospital systems. And you realize that on one end, pharmaceutical companies only publish about 1/10 of the studies that they do so that they make sure that their study they publish is the one that shows that their pill works. Even if they have other studies that don't show that, they won't publish those studies. So suddenly, what are we talking about for evidence? That's not good science. And then on the other side of things, you want to see that there's great evidence that massage therapy is super beneficial for your lymphatic system, for post and preoperative care, for injury. So we've got research happening on kind of both sides. And so a lot of these research institutions are getting very interested in that.
I agree. I think that I was around when they brought in evidence-based practice, and when they first tried to sell it to us, they were saying it's going to be the evidence in the literature, the patient's experience, and the clinician's, you know, judgment, and where those three intersect, and, you know, that is where what's best for the patient. And what I saw happen over the last 20 years is that the big pharm has the money and finances to fund randomly controlled trials that cost millions of dollars to run, and they threw out what the patient wanted as well as what, you know, your clinician experience was, and it all became about what the algorithm that they created that most people are following now, called algorithmic medicine, in my mind, is just following the big pharm algorithms to make sure that their medications are the first choice, and they've thrown away a lot of the other options for people in that system. And I find that kind of unfortunate, because when it first came out, it was an intersection of what people, the client would like, as well as the, you know, provider's experience with the evidence and where those three intersected, and it's no longer being practiced that way.
That's so interesting, because when we first heard about evidence-based, you know, practice, and again, those algorithms, some of us sat back and said, that's kind of like a cookbook medicine. Totally. You know, I want to be able to do, you know, what I have learned from my training, plus what I've learned from my patients, because a lot of times it's the experience of certain medicines or certain treatments with the patient that make you want to try something else. But
yes, and I found that very sad that they would throw away that kind of experience, because I find that that's very valuable.
So, there's so many different, we'll talk a little bit about herbal medicines, then we'll go back to treatments. But do you suggest any of these? And I'm just going to name a whole bunch, and you can say whether you do or not. St. John's wort.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think we should go through the giant list and say yes or no. I do.
But
your point is you know, the over-the-counter or herbal treatments, I use lots of them.
Yes.
And for very specific points, for short durations, which I think Jill was pointing out, you know, this isn't a lifelong. I don't think most people should be on any supplement for their life.
No.
I think that they're for strategic uses. Melatonin, you brought that up a couple times. It's a great compound. We make it inside of our body. It helps people fall asleep. If you're having a hard time falling asleep, that's your kind of insomnia. is, you know, sleep onset insomnia. Mm-hmm. Melatonin can be super helpful and beneficial.
Well, melatonin is also good for other things because they're using it for cancer treatments as well at very high doses because of its effects on the mitochondria. Most people only think about melatonin and where it comes from the pineal gland and affecting with sleep. But I find that there's a lot more roles of melatonin. And if you look into Dr. Merrick's work, he has been showing how that can be used for mitochondrial treatments for cancer. Hmm. And so there's a lot of other things outside of just sleep help for melatonin. I also know I use melatonin a lot to help women with hot flashes. Huh. And so there's a lot of other modalities of use for some of these things than you might see in the standard shelf.
Okay. Interesting.
And they're using it for COVID, actually, as like a, just for antiviral.
Yeah.
So I put people on 3 nights of melatonin, just 3 nights. If you've got just, like a viral infection, just three nights in a row, and that's it.
It really works as a good, it works great for illness as well.
So you can rest better while you're sick. And
unless you're somebody who gets nightmares from melatonin, which a lot of people do, at which point we don't use melatonin.
Right.
Because
it needs to be individualized care. All.
Exactly right.
What success have you had with chondroitin sulfate? Because I know, again, I'm just picking out ones that I have used over the years, and people would say, oh, you have to buy this brand. It's the best. And then we would use it for 3 months, and it would still...
I save a lot of people money when I tell them to stop taking the majority of their supplements.
I agree.
I recommend things like bone broth, and I recommend things that have natural, typically animal forms of collagens in them to help rebuild. Chondroitin is in the collagens of bone broth, so you can find it in there in a natural form. A lot of supplements are made in factories with synthetic compounds that are either plant forms or kind of inorganic forms. So, you know, if you
and
look
they're on contaminated and they're as well.
Oh, for sure. I mean, we're not even talking about the process, just what the actual thing is. You know, people get their zinc as zinc oxide. That's an inert like mineral that's like from like the industrial process.
Yeah, mining.
From mining, exactly right. And so it's not really a beneficial
form of
zinc. You're
not supposed to eat rocks.
Yeah,
you know?
If you want to like lick a nail, a rusty nail, like, you know, a zinc-plated rusty nail, then you get your iron and your zinc if you think of it that way. But our bodies have evolved over millions of years to recognize very specific forms of elements and compounds, proteins, enzymes, etc. And we just pass it through if our body doesn't recognize what it is. So
that's very interesting. So if I have a cold, I should go find a rusty nail.
Yeah, find a rusty nail. You got it. If you took anything from this conversation, rusty nails are the solution.
And we really don't recommend that. But
no, I agree with him too. I think food first is always my approach to things because your body knows what to do with food. The reason supplements get so expensive is because they're trying to manufacture them in a way to trick your body into thinking that they're food so you'll absorb them. But when I worked in the ICU, I used to call a lot of the supplements bedpan bullets because I would see them come out looking exactly the way they went in. So I used to make fun of that a lot when I was an ICU nurse. And so I'm very particular about thinking of food first and really testing and seeing what supplements might be helpful, but more focusing on what foods have those things in them so they can get it from that first and then maybe support that if that's impossible for them.
Very interesting, because I've often told patients that vitamins and supplements just make expensive urine. So
they do.
That's kind of what you all said, too.
Yeah, 100%.
And on the flip side, what foods not to eat? Such as, you know, do you have an intolerance to gluten? Is that creating leaky gut or whatever?
Sure.
That could be taking the really good food that you're eating and not really ingesting it as you call it, medicine or to help your body.
Well, there's so many of these rabbit holes, right? So you go to Europe, you brought up Europe before. You ever eat bread in Europe and you're totally fine, but you eat it here and you can't? Well, we spray a lot of our wheat with glyphosate, which is a known disruptor. Actually, it's a descaler for old boilers. That's how it was first used. So this is a cleaning agent for industrial machinery that now we're using to kill plants so that we can grow our one thing that maybe was genetically modified or maybe not. But so we're getting that on our food. That's disrupting our GI tract. And that's why there's a lot of theory behind our gluten issues is actually a glyphosate issue because old strains or non-glyphosate grains people have no problem with.
So it's complicated.
It's complicated. It's always complicated.
Super complicated. Jeremy, I know that you're using some hyperbaric treatment. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so hyperbaric oxygen therapy is... it is a way to infuse the body with more oxygen by just using principles of physics. So you get into a chamber, which can be soft or hard, you know, made of metal or made of like a polyvinyl canvas. It's pressurized to a certain pressure of air. So the one I have is the same as being 10 feet underwater. So not too much pressure. Pop your ears once or twice and you breathe supplemental oxygen. And what that does is it allows the oxygen, excuse me, which is typically carried around by your red blood cells to all the places in your body, to dissolve in the liquid of your blood. Just like when you crack open a seltzer and the bubbles suddenly appear and that seltzer was hard at first, those bubbles kind of bubble out. We're doing the opposite. We're kind of pushing those oxygen bubbles inside of your body. And that helps with a lot of modalities of healing. There's 14 FDA-approved uses of hyperbarics. Insurance will pay for those. There's a chamber down in Kootenai, down in Coeur d'Alene, that they use for wound healing typically. However, lots of research is showing that it's incredibly beneficial for almost everything, and I hate to kind of claim anything as a panacea, but oxygen is one of the most critical components of all healing processes for the mitochondria. For every part of our body requires oxygen, and that's usually the ingredient we're missing the most. You know, we can supplement with a lot of things, and oxygen's the problem, especially in inflammatory states. So I use oxygen, I use hyperbarics or HBOT or hyperbaric oxygen therapy for a lot of modalities. My favorite ones are head injuries. You know, working in the ERs for years, you hit your head, we do a scan of your head, you're not bleeding, take some Tylenol, go home, be in the dark, we're really sorry that happened to you.
Make sure you can't detox from your Tylenol.
yeah, right, exactly. Yes, exactly. And that's our therapy for that. And I can get people feeling really, really good in under a week just using hyperbarics, because we're kind of oxygenating the brain in a way that gets around that inflammatory change. So I'm a really huge fan of hyperbarics. I've seen a lot of stuff that I was told was impossible work really great with hyperbarics.
It's phenomenal. Definitely go see Jeremy for hyperbarics. That's great stuff.
Okay. There's so many other treatments that we probably can't get into them all. I've had massage, roll. I've never had been rolfed. manipulation by both chiropractors and osteopaths. Never had acupuncture, dry needling, physical therapists do now. So, and just physical therapy in general, and stretching and building up the proper muscles. But I'm fascinated or want to emphasize again, as Jill said, that we should get our nutrients from food. And as Jeremy alluded to, because other substances that we can buy over the counter are often not regulated. Are there other modalities or other comments that you would like to add? Things that are your favorite in functional medicine?
I'll take one. I think people ask me, you know, I work with a lot of longevity, so you know, that's another kind of field of medicine that's getting bigger. How do I live the longest? How do I not just live the longest, but have great health span? How am I healthy for the longest period of time? And people ask me all the time, you know, what's the number one thing? Everyone wants that. What's the number one thing? And the number one thing is community. And it's been shown in studies, so we can pull out evidence for it. And you've brought that up a ton of times, which is great. I think, you know, who we surround ourselves with, the communities that we're part of, we feel a sense of purpose, and that gives us a reason to live and to be healthy.
Yep, we have to come from a place of love. We have to love ourselves as well as love our neighbors and our enemies. And so I think it's really important for the community to come together and not have division like we've seen for the last 5 years.
Yeah. I just realized that the other couple of therapies that I didn't think of that, again, go along with your sense of community, too, is relaxation.
Yep.
And meditation. So whatever helps each individual to relax, not exactly go with the flow. You can certainly express your opinions, but to be part of a community can be really helpful.
It helps to balance your nervous system.
I've noticed lately there's a lot of online communities focused on health. There could be a community of meditators, stress reducers, of breathing techniques.
Oh, sure.
And you talk about oxygen. There's ways to enhance that level in your body through breathing techniques.
Oh, breath work is huge for me.
Breath work.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
And so those are communities too. Meditation, yoga. There's all kinds of opportunities, just finding it without, as you say, supplements are a possibility, but not a final outcome.
Yeah, I break it down into tiers when I talk to people about what are the tiers of kind of the biggest bang for your buck, the low-hanging fruit. And it's always, you know, community, breath work, food, movement, and sleep. Those are the big ones. And then kind of the next tier are interventions that seem to really be helpful. So for me, you know, I'm really big on hyperbaric oxygen therapy, but, you know, cold plunging, there's plenty of evidence that's very beneficial. You know, saunas, tons of evidence, especially out of the Nordic countries for why they're so much healthier than a lot of us. They do sauna all the time. So there's all these kind of different tiers of how we can bring in health into our lives and stay healthy as individuals and as a group.
So you can write a letter if I want to put a sauna in my house. You can write a medical justification to my insurance company to pay for it.
I can write you a letter. We can see. I'm pretty sure insurance doesn't care about preventative medicine. They haven't yet. Maybe they're starting to think about it.
I think insurance's main focus is cost containment, not your health.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, absolutely.
Anyway, and Susie, when you mentioned breathing, it's interesting. There is a book called Breathe or Breath.
Yeah, Breath,
and
James
Nestor. Yeah, I read that about a year and a half ago. My daughter gave it to me.
It's on my library of, if you're my patient, you read this book.
Yes.
And the other key to that is doing it.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, right, so if you take a walk every day, breathe while you're walking.
Yeah.
You know, and if.
Which is better than not breathing while you're walking.
And any amount is better than none. Also another thought I always have: a little bit of yoga, a little bit of stretching, breathing when I walk.
Yeah,
it's integrative.
Yeah. Have you tried walking up the stairs with your mouth closed?
I'm not sure, but I will try that.
Yeah,
because that's in his. That's, you know, so much of what's in his book that we're not supposed to breathe out of our mouth.
Yeah, nasal breathing is so important. Yeah. Oh, there's some crazy stuff. I mean, it sounds nuts, but it's called sleep taping or mouth taping, which is when you literally tape your mouth closed while you sleep, which sounds like an insane thing. But you can go online and see there's an overwhelming amount of evidence about how beneficial it is.
Just putting your tongue to the roof of your mouth is very critical.
Changes your teeth, changes your sleep, changes the quality of your sleep, the restorative nature of your sleep.
Change your entire autonomic nervous system.
For sure.
Set point.
Amazing. If you didn't know anything and you just heard this podcast today, show, what would you Google to find out more?
Oh, my gosh. We've talked about a lot of stuff
far.
I think, what is real food? I would look into that.
The real
food. I would just start looking at what you're eating.
Yeah.
And just paying attention, because I think a lot of people don't even look at what they're eating. And I think there's a huge movement right now for people to start paying attention, just looking at our products. Even in processed food in America is very different than in other countries. And so I think it's important for people just to start paying attention to what they're putting in their mouth, because my grandmother always told me, you are what you eat. But what I learned is, you are what you eat, drink, think, and breathe, but don't eliminate. And so that's kind of how I look at the human body.
So again, walk the margins of the grocery store, primarily shop at the margins. Well, Jeremy and Jill, thank you so much for joining me today. It was so informative to learn about functional medicine here in the Sandpoint area. And thank you all for listening to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne. Please do remember that this is a medical information show. It does not substitute for discussing your concerns with your medical provider. Just a little FYI, and Susie will cut me off when I need to be finishing, but March 8th is International Women's Day, and it's also the 30th anniversary of the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action for International Women's Day. Thought that was super interesting. The day will be celebrated at the UN in the General Assembly Hall from 10 to 11:30 on Friday, March 7th. When my children were young, I used to read to them a book called Girls Can Be Anything. And so that was in the 70s. And they were raised in an area with great opportunity. Unfortunately, not all women and girls are so fortunate. And so we're not talking only about opportunities in equality in education and employment, but also to be free of intimate partner violence and violence against women in general. So, again, thank you for listening to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne. Please tune in next month on April 7th when we'll be discussing child maltreatment, protection, and support services, featuring CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocate Guardian Ad Litem. Again, thank you, Jeremy, Alan, and Jill Stiller, for being here with me. This is 88.5 KRFY. Community Radio for North Idaho.